Welcome to Between the Vines. My name is Kevin Martin. Thank you all for joining us. We are going to bring you another coffee pot meeting that we had this week. We had a special guest, Dr. Richard Stubb. We will be back to our more regularly scheduled programming soon, but we did want to share this coffee pot meeting with you because we had some great discussion on the labor supply in our area and where Dr. Stubb thinks that is trending and where it will go in the future, and maybe some possible solutions. So we're looking forward to sharing that with you, and we also look forward to being with you again in our more traditional way soon.
Dr. Richard Stubb comes to us from the agricultural workforce at Cornell University. He addresses challenges facing the agricultural industry through educational programs and applied research. He also provides leadership as a liaison between the agricultural industry and the employment-focused regulatory authorities. So his focus is on human resource management, enhancing employee engagement, regulatory compliance, and leadership development at the farm level. So I would like you all to welcome Richard with us today. And do you want to try to share your screen and tell a little bit about yourself, Richard?
You bet.
Thank you for joining us.
Hey, you're quite welcome. Glad to be here. So hello, everyone. I'm glad to be with you. Looking forward to that time when we'll all be able to get together in person, but also appreciating these opportunities with using Zoom. I think we educators as well as producers out there have come a long way with Zoom and using this kind of technology. And I think we're going to, find a place for it even going forward when we're fully back to normal. But so Jen gave me a challenging topic, right? So what do we do about the workforce? How do we get more people and all that? And, if I could give you a straightforward answer or wave a magic wand around that, then I could be a very rich person right now, I would think, because that's a huge issue that's confronting every sector of agriculture. But let's not stop there. That's confronting the economy across the board right now. It's a real challenge, and it's certainly not just limited to farms. But I got some thoughts, both some short-term things and some longer-term things that we need to be thinking about. And I just wanted to throw this slide up. This is a super basic model of a business, right? And so all those things in the blue to the left are just the stuff that you would need to have in order to run a business, all the inputs that you need to have. In your case, it'd be land, it'd be vines. There's certainly financing, facilities, production knowledge, that's really important. But then there's workforce. And I've thought over the years that, workforce has kind of been taken for granted. I'm not just pointing the finger at farms or agriculture on that, but in a lot of places, the workforce was taken for granted. Well, those days are long gone, I think. Now people are really focused on, where am I going to get a workforce? Who's going to come and do this work? Because, some of these other things, I can get all the financing I want, and I can, get access to land if I want to. But, am I going to be able to have people to do the job? And it's really impacting that. Not taken for granted anymore. By way of agenda, just a couple of things I want to cover today. And there's a lot of material, and I'm going to go quickly in some areas, but I definitely want to leave us some time for some good questions and answers as well. But just a little bit of background context. I'm going to look at some numbers, both short-term and long-term numbers on employment, something around immigration and migration. We'll talk briefly about H-2A and some of the changes that are happening there. We won't get a whole lot into policy and potential changes. Talk a little bit about becoming an employer of choice. Now, any of these I could pick out and we could do, a whole workshop on any of those. So understand we're going to be skimming the surface a little bit. And then I want to wrap up with a little bit of an idea that I think its time has come about really where are we going as an industry with regard to workforce development. All right, a little bit of that context. I keep track of the numbers as much as I can. This is 20 years of U.S. unemployment here since the turn of the century. And, I will try to get the, yeah, there we go. A little bit of a laser pointer here. But we remember this unemployment back there at the housing crisis. You know, we called it the Great Recession. And then we had this long, long period of gains in employment all the way right up until, well, we know what this was, the pandemic, right? And so everybody, the economy shut down and, you know, unemployment like we never saw. But then this dramatic drop, and it's actually dropped, continuing to drop pretty quickly. We're, you know, on track to get back to that 5% unemployment level, which, you know, a lot of economists consider that full, anything below 5% is full employment. So we're on that path to get back there fairly quickly. So this is an interesting graph, and that is the number of unemployed persons per job opening. So take the number of people who don't have a job right now and are looking relative to the number of job openings that are currently available out there. So in other words, if there's one job opening per one for each unemployed person, then we'd be at one right here. You know, in normal times, there's more job openings than there are people, but we had this, you know, spike way up at that time period, and then we had this other spike just in the recent time period. But just before the pandemic, we had this interesting phenomenon for about 2 years where we had more job openings than we had people in the country who were looking for work. So in other words, even if, and you can never do this, you can never match all those unemployed people with the qualifications needed for those jobs that happen to be available. But even if we could, we didn't have enough bodies to go around to fill those jobs. So, you know, we couldn't meet this without immigration. Then we had this period of time, and now we're heading back to that scenario where there's not enough bodies to go around to fill those jobs. Again, that's just not agriculture. That's the whole economy. All right, let's talk about immigration a little bit, because that is important to agriculture. This is looking back over that was about 40-year time frame there. But those of us who've been in the industry for at least part of that time, we know that immigration was really important in a variety of ways. Most of that immigration was from Mexico. And this is over the years, this is a proxy. We don't know how many people were exactly crossing the border illegally, right? But we do know how many were apprehended, because the government tracks that. So it's a proxy, an estimation of how many people were actually crossing the border. Well, it was primarily Mexicans, of course, and then we had this smaller group of non-Mexicans. Interesting things happened there around 2016, where the number of Mexicans crossing went way down, and the number of non-Mexicans crossing had actually exceeded the number of Mexicans for a period of time. Now, when this time period back in the 90s, 2000s, there were a lot of people coming over from Mexico. And what were they coming for? They were coming for jobs. They'd been coming for decades for that. And that's what happened. They came over. We had a lot of border tightening things that happened after the turn of the century, beginning with 9/11. And then in the years after that, you know, expanded dramatically in the Trump administration. And this cut back dramatically on the number of Mexicans who came across. And understand, again, those of you that remember, there was a time when people came across from Mexico and went back and forth on a regular basis. That was like that circular migration. That just doesn't happen anymore. That, you know, when people get into the country, they stay. And so that's that whole feature has changed our industry and our workforce dramatically. Here's some newer information that I wanted to share with you. And this is... I wish I could make that disappear. There's a little thing blocking the top of my screen, but so I can't read the title. But anyways, this is border crossings. Again, the similar data. It's a more recent time period. And this kind of yellowish area, this is single adults. So that would, you know, in many cases, we don't know for sure, but most of these folks, I'm sure, are people from Mexico. And then this gray area is like family units. And then the green is those unaccompanied minors that we've heard about so much in the news. We need to understand that these are different. These are people coming for different reasons. The gray and the green, those family units and unaccompanied minors, predominantly those are people seeking asylum. And they're in many cases coming from some of those Central American countries, Guatemala, Honduras. And the yellow is that more traditional group of Mexicans seeking work in the United States. So we see that the Mexican group had gone down considerably, but now it's gone way back up. So this is a little bit of a trend to watch, because there is an increasing number of people coming over to the United States now that the pandemic seems to have at least settled down in parts of the country, that are starting to come over for jobs as the economy heats up. And boy, is the economy heating up. But we need to be mindful of some longer term trends too. And I like to share this with everyone. This is again, focusing on Mexico. And this is the fertility rate in Mexico. So back in the 60s and 70s, and especially, but things dropped off in the 70s, the fertility rate, which is measured by the number of children who are born per woman in a country. And I think this is the World Bank that keeps this. Yeah, World Bank keeps this information for every country in the world. But that number dropped way off. So women in Mexico are having far fewer children by the 2000s than they were back in 1970. So let's put this in our minds. All those people that were coming across back in the 90s and 2000s, if they were 20, 25 years old, when were they born? Oh, they were born back here around 1970, weren't they? But those people that are in their 20s and maybe looking to migrate for work today, when were they born? Oh, they were born around 2000. And guess what? There's not nearly as many of them. This is really important for agriculture. Longer term, Mexico, which is our large neighbor, 130 million people in Mexico, has contributed dramatically to U.S. Agriculture workforce over the recent decades, simply isn't having as many children. There's not as much push to immigrate to the United States. There is economic growth in Mexico as that country continues to develop, and there will not be as many people coming into the U.S. agriculture from Mexico as there were in the past. Bottom line, that pipeline that many of us used for all those decades, it's drying up and there's nothing we can do about it. U.S. farm workforce trends. This is a long-term trend and you all know this one. I love this. They stopped collecting this data back around 2000. This is USDA's. And so I'm glad that they made some different color choices since that time, but this was the graph that USDA had available. Just looking at number of workers on farms and a number of farms, historically over that period of time in the 20th century, we know this story. The number of farms went down and the number of workers went down dramatically. And this has an impact on U.S. agriculture, but it also had an impact on our entire economy. And as all those people left farms and moved to more urban areas, and the industrial growth of the United States occurred largely because of that. But that's the story. Things stabilized by the end of the 20th century in terms of number of farms and also number of workers to a large degree. And I suspect that this track has continued with decline of both, but on a slower rate. I'm sorry, actually number of farms actually has started to increase because of the number of small farms that have started up. Here's looking at some similar data, but it is a little bit similar time period, just a shorter time period, 50 years. This is number of hired farm workers and the number of family farm workers. You see, it used to be a lot more family farm workers, and then the number of hired farm workers has become proportionally much more important up into recent times. I suspect that trend has also stabilized and stayed pretty similar. It's unfortunate USDA doesn't collect these data anymore.
Just to add some context, yes. Richard, for our industry in our region, we do have the Census of Ag, and I haven't looked at workers, but with farms, we've lost about half of our vineyard farmers since 2000. We're down about 50%.
Okay. Good to know. Thanks, Kevin.
Yep.
And I drilled down into New York's numbers a little bit more. I've been following, actually, I've been using these a lot in the last year. It slipped my mind that there would be Pennsylvania producers on here as well. So I'm sorry, I didn't pull the Pennsylvania numbers. Just to drill down into New York a little bit more, this is using Census of Ag numbers. And what I've done is pulled out the number of farms, operations, and hired employees based on the type of farm. So we got fruit and tree nut, which would include the grape industry, which is in New York, that is the highest number of employees is in that sector, about 24%. Now, that being said, you know, we know a number of those employees are temporary or seasonal. And then we have dairy, which is, you know, often thought of as the large industry, but in terms of a workforce, it's number two in New York. But they would be more long-term and less seasonal in nature. But then vegetable and greenhouse. So those are the four that I tend to focus on a lot: fruit and tree nut, dairy, vegetable, and greenhouse. But I just thought you'd like to see that context a little bit. This is down from almost 61,000 in the 2012 census before that. And before you know it, we'll have a new census coming out. I wanted to share a little bit more data here. There were 16,000, again, these are hired workers. There were 16,000 operations with unpaid workers, which would be primarily family workers, and 40,000 unpaid workers. So just put that in context. So the number of hired employees was 55,000. The number of unpaid, typically family workers, would be 40,000. So I just like people to keep that in mind. You know, we're talking about 95,000 people altogether. So the family workforce is still quite important in U.S. agriculture. Here's another trend that is important to look at. Now, we have to use the data that we have available. We don't always have perfect data available. This comes from the National Ag Workers Survey, which they do every couple of years. Unfortunately, it is a nationwide survey, so this is national data, but unfortunately, it is just crop industry, so we don't have the other industries in there, but it's all types of crop producing industries. But I like this because it gives us more of an illustration of what is happening with that traditional migrant farm workforce that we've had for a long time. The way you read this is that the green portion of that is people who are working in the crop industry that are non-migrant, that are settled in one place. That's the green portion. The yellow portion then is people who are migrants who actually follow the crop. So those are the people that move from one part of the country to another, migrating along, following the crop. That's what the traditional sector that we think of, that there's been movies about, and they get a lot of press and that sort of thing. The migrant group that is called a shuttler, those are people that are primarily based in one place, but do shuttle back and forth to another area. So, for example, we have a lot of people that come for apple harvest in New York. And a lot of those folks are from the South, from Florida, Georgia, and they don't follow the crop, but they do shuttle up here for the apple harvest in the fall. And then the blue, the light blue on top is those newcomers. Those are people who just haven't been established in the industry long enough to have a pattern yet. So the interesting thing, this time period starts in 91, goes up through 2016. Look at this strong trend that we have. The green bar has grown. Everything else has actually declined. I guess the migrant shuttler has held its own, but that traditional follow the crop has declined pretty dramatically. Our workforce is much more settled than it used to be. People aren't moving around nearly as much as they used to. So that's changed. And there's a couple of other things that we'll get into that kind of reinforce that trend. This is briefly just the legal status, and I'm going to speed up a little bit here. We know that among that hired crop farm workforce, about half are unauthorized to work in the country. I hate to use the term unauthorized rather than undocumented because everyone has documents, right? But those documents may or may not be authentic. Here's another statistic that reinforces what we were just talking about. So this is looking at the whole unauthorized population in the country. This is Pew Research Center data. But most unauthorized immigrants are now long-term U.S. residents. And we find this regularly on farms. That it's no longer those, I'll say typically guys, because it is predominantly men in the industry, but it's no longer those guys that have only been here for a year or two. A lot of our workforce has been here for 10 plus years. We know that. And I'm sure a lot of your farms, you have immigrants who have been there for years and years. But on average, the typical unauthorized immigrant in the United States now has been here more than 10 years. That kind of blows people's minds when they understand that, that this is really, and people have settled down, they have families, in a lot of cases they've bought a house and have really become a true permanent resident, permanent immigrant into the country. Okay, so all that being said, I boil down the U.S. Workforce in this way. Five different groups. We've got farmers and their family members who are still important across all sectors and regions of the country. We've got this large population of long-term settled immigrants who have come into the country. They're mostly Hispanic. Many of them, those folks still are unauthorized to work in the country. We've got a large population of U.S. citizens in rural communities who still work on farms. And I always talk about this group because I have the opportunity sometimes to be in some legislative processes and that sort of thing and talk to legislators. And they always consistently forget this group or ignore this group. But there's tons of local people who still work in agriculture. And we need to not forget them and make sure that they're at the policy table. And there's a smaller population of more recent immigrants, both unauthorized and authorized. And then we've got the fifth group, which is this rapidly growing population of H-2A workers, fully authorized to be here on a temporary basis. That's really what our workforce is today. So if we think about expanding and accessing more employees, it's kind of got to come from one of these five groups, unless we are able to get very creative and find some new groups to come from. But this is, as far as I can tell, these are the five that we draw from. All right, I'm gonna jump into the H-2A program a little bit. And again, we can come back for questions or that sort of thing, but I'm just gonna overview it briefly because it's so important and is probably one of the most likely sources of new employees. To get into it, you have to be an ag employer, you have to have a full-time jobs at least 35 hours, has to be seasonal, and growers, contractors, and associations can all participate in H-2A. Very simple process, right? No, I'm making a joke about that because it is a complex process. Some of you out there probably participate in H-2A. This is just the first portion of it to get through the U.S. Department of Labor portion. When you get through this chart, then you're headed into the immigration services or the visa process. So it is complex, and it takes about 3 years to really figure out the process and how to make it work. All that being said, it's really grown. This is the national numbers, and looking at different states, the different colors represent different states. New York happens to be this kind of a medium green color right there. And back as recently as 07, we were, you know, proportionally a pretty big player. We're still important, and we've been in it for a long time, New York has. You know, the growth has been in these kind of brown-colored states here, and that is North Carolina, California, Washington, Georgia, Florida. That's where the story is. Look how they expanded over this period of time. Massive growth in those states in participation in the H-2A program. That's how they've built their industries, and that's how they've continued to build their farms. Drilling in a little bit on New York, we've continued to grow. That's a pretty substantial growth from 2012 to 2020, even with all the difficulties that we had getting people into the country last year, it still grew. And I'll be really interested to see what happens in 2021 in terms of our numbers. In New York, the two big populations that we have are people from Jamaica and people from Mexico. And this Jamaican group, there's people that have been coming for 50 years from Jamaica. It's really interesting. Some of those countries in the Caribbean are very well organized. I've met some of the people from the government of Jamaica who help to connect farms with workers and help to support their employees or their residents when they're in the country and that sort of thing. And it's been an interesting development over the years. And Mexico is really growing, an increasing number of people coming on H-2A. From Mexico, but H-2A continues to be incredibly important. And for many of you, again, that might be a source of getting additional workers. And, you know, it's not just the big farms, you know, there are large farms out there that are bringing in hundreds of workers on H-2A in New York. There are also a whole lot that are bringing in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 workers on the H-2A program. All right. let's talk a little bit about another aspect of this. So this is, you know, keeping and retaining our employees. And we could go for a long time on this topic, but it's really a set of reminders here. Briefly, I grew up on a dairy farm. I used to work in the industry, and I had the opportunity with a person that was a client of mine in the business that I had, where I was filling in for Bruce because his significant other lived in another state and he liked to go see her on weekends. Well, Bruce had a small farm, and you know, because I grew up on a farm, I knew how to do some of these things. But the tractor I had to use to start to feed the cows, you know, you had to do a rolling start and pop the clutch to get it going. I had to bang on the silo unloader electrical box in order to get it to run. I had to climb down this hole because sometimes a breaker would trip on the well pump. I had to climb down this hole in order to reset that breaker. You know, it's not easy to find someone that can do that kind of work. It's really not very professional. It's certainly not safe. I wondered sometimes when I was climbing down that hole, if I got electrocuted, how long it would take them to find me. But that's what is not a very professional workplace. So what is a professional workplace or an unprofessional, you know, lack of concern for quality, lack of concern for safety, carelessness, lack of concern for the employees themselves, maybe our lack of respect for employees. And we've got a changing workforce. We've got a lot more women working in the workforce. And that's an old-fashioned calendar there, of course, with a photograph that doesn't fit anymore with our workforce today. But I still see this sort of stuff on farms, and it's time to move beyond that. Time for those calendars to come down. A professional workplace then is one that gives employees that sense of pride and respect, helps them to focus on their work, eliminates these obstacles to performing, communicates those values about high quality, safe work, meets employees' needs while they're at work. So let me dig into those a little bit more. And I just want you, again, I know I'm going fast and I'm just throwing some ideas out there, but I want you to be thinking critically about your own workforce or your own place of work and the environment you create for employees as you try to retain them. So is it organized? You know, are the tools in the right place? Is the materials where it ought to be? Is it clean? You know, we're in food production after all. Is it in good repair? And I put an old tractor up there, right? This is one of the ones I liked on our farm, an old 966. But you know what? Things don't have to be new. That's not the message I'm sending here. But they need to work. They need to work the way they were designed, and they need to be safe. Safe, you know, we've got NICAM, and we've got other safety resources in New York, and Penn State has a great safety program. Safety equipment and shields in place. You know, there shouldn't be any unshielded PTOs out there anymore. Personal protective equipment that's fit tested, all those sort of things. That's what professionals do. But then it's also about meeting employees' needs. You know, I've been in a lot of farms, right? And I've seen bathrooms like that. Is that okay today? If we want to attract people and keep them on our workplace, often we've got men and women in the workplace. That's not okay. You know, we don't need to be like that anymore. Clean and presentable in larger workplaces, separate bathrooms. You know, accommodate the women that are working in our workplace. These are the things that we need to do. You know, break rooms, lockers, that sort of thing. Make those investments to be professional in our workplace, to get people, whether it's local people or whether it's H2A, whoever it is, to understand that this is a legitimate place of work. We're thinking about the employees, and we intend to make it a good work environment and a good place for you to be. And here's another elephant in the room, right? That's pay. You know, and this is always a controversial subject. And I, you know, I'm right there with you. I understand the challenges. I understand H2A and the cost that's going up. I understand minimum wage and our competition relative to others. But here's a hard fact that we need to be aware of. What we're looking at here, is the blue area is the average. This is non-supervisory. So these are our frontline employees, not managers, not supervisors. Non-supervisory farm wage as a percent of the average non-farm wages. Our farm wages represent only about, you know, as of about 2019, about 60% of what non-farm wages were. Now, I know there's a lot of industries in there that are able to pay more, you know, plumbers, electricians, those industries can earn a lot. And I know that's in there, but just, you know, the hard fact is we're only at 60% of the average non-farm wage, and something we need, you know, we've been growing on it, That line above that is the average real wage for non-supervisory farm workers. Yeah, that's been growing over time. And we're gaining on the other industries, but we're not there yet. We're only a percentage of what other workers earn. Now, I'll wrap up this section right here with this idea of supervisory leadership. We were teaching a whole course on that because we have a lot of people in the industry that have really never had any training on how do I lead people? I'm a frontline supervisor. I'm new to supervising people, or I'm a middle manager that's never had any training. And people will ask me, where do I start? Where do I begin to become a much better manager of people? And I start right there. I call it the performance triad. It's three pieces that are straightforward, right? Expectations is the foundation of it. If I want to be good as an employer and I want to retain people, I need to communicate well what they're supposed to be doing, when they're doing it, how they're doing it. Set those expectations and those performance levels very, very clearly. The second leg of that triangle, then, if I want to increase performance, is training. I need to do a great job at training people, helping them to learn the knowledge and skills that they need. And then the third leg is feedback. And that is, I need to help them know whether they're doing a good job or not such a good job. And I do that by giving them regular feedback on an ongoing basis. Most of that feedback for average or better performers is positive. Hey, you did a great job with that. I really appreciate how you're trimming those vines. Keep up the good work. So for normal performers, it's positive feedback. How much does that cost you? It costs you nothing. That's part of the job as of being a supervisor and creating that professional environment. So that whole thing, we've just been talking about some thoughts and ideas. And again, that's, you know, for the local workforce, for the immigrant workforce, really for anybody that's working on your farm, all those things that we talked about, the professional workforce and better supervision are things that you should do for all of your employees. But if we want to get back into the local workforce, maybe we need to think creatively about that. You know, some businesses are recruiting all the time, just to find people, and they're looking for people on a regular basis. Maybe we need to be thinking about that from a farm standpoint. You know, how can we be constantly recruiting, constantly finding people? Some businesses, you know, with the increased immigration enforcement, did actively and consciously turn back to the local workforce and had some success. It's not easy, but they're able to have some success and to bring on some additional people to limit their risk of immigration enforcement. Is it some second shift employees? Can you get some people there after 3 o'clock when that first shift ends, or, you know, whatever time period, or before their shift begins? Is it, you know, in this pandemic, there's been more women who left the workplace. Are there some opportunities to get some moms that maybe, can't access the childcare that they need to get them back there, to get them at work at your place for even part of the year? Could you provide some childcare? You know, I'm just trying to think creatively outside of the box. I know it wouldn't work for everybody. The formerly incarcerated, are there some opportunities to give people a second chance? Are those recovering from addiction or students? You know, can we get outside of our traditional groups and try to think differently about where we might pull employees in? And that brings me really to the longer term, to this whole idea of workforce development. And, you know, it's really important to define this a little bit, but when I talk about workforce development, I like this Ohio State definition, which is the coordination of public and private sector policies and programs that provide individuals with the opportunity for sustainable livelihood. So it's thinking about sustainable jobs and income for the employees and helps businesses achieve their goals, their exemplary goals. It's got to be workforce development. It's got to be both about the people, the working there, the employees, and the business has got to make a living. So what can we do there? Some of the other industries are working hard on this. This wouldn't be a new thing for agriculture. This is the construction industry. I just pulled a couple of things off some websites. They're actively trying to get people because they have the same worker shortages that we have. Oh, wow, healthcare. You know, that's a prestige industry in the U.S. It's a growing industry in the U.S., yet they struggle. If any of you have nurses in your family, you know how much that nursing shortage has been going on now for 20 years. National Retail Federation, even retail is trying to do workforce development in order to secure a pipeline longer term. I think we're behind the times in agriculture. We need to get after this. There's some good models out there. I had the opportunity not too long ago to learn more about Kentucky's equine workforce development. Now, of all parts of agriculture, I would think the horse industry would have the easiest time attracting people to come work in it because, you know, people that are horse people love horses and want to work there. But they've got a workforce development program in place. It's called KEEP. They are doing an apprenticeship. They have a prison program where they're bringing people out of the prisons. They have a farm where they're teaching them skills around horsemanship. They're looking at different populations. They're building those career pathways, which we've started a little bit in agriculture. They're doing what they can for second chance employment, vocational training for those people in recovery from drug addiction, that sort of thing. So they're organized and they are trying to build a pipeline to keep enough people working in Kentucky's horse industry. I think we need to be thinking bigger. You know, it's not just the grape industry. It's not just production agriculture. It's not just dairy or apples. I think we need to be thinking about our production side of it, which I tried to include a few pictures over here, our processing side of our industry, which, you know, I've worked in some dairy processing plants, done some consulting, and a lot of the skills are directly transferable back to dairy farms. And I'll bet we'd find this in other processors as well. And then all the way to the retail, however we're reaching the end consumer. If we came at this as one food industry, which has the opportunity for people to, first of all, it makes us bigger, it makes us more noticeable by policymakers, but also it gives potential employees an opportunity to realize that, you know, I could work on a farm, I could work in manufacturing, and maybe part of my career, I'd move back and forth as I'm climbing a ladder somewhere. But it's one food industry, and I think we need to start thinking about it that way. This idea of ladders, and I'm getting a little wonky here in the workforce development field, but it's not just climbing up through one industry. It can potentially be back and forth. So like I say, from manufacturing to the farm level, and we need to be thinking about how are we recruiting for our industry? Because we've got some positives. We've got some advantages in agriculture. It's the diversity of the work that we do. It's the fact that we get to be outside in the sunshine sometimes, and then sometimes we get to be inside. And, you know, other industries, people have found that they don't want to be stuck in cubicles anymore. This whole issue where people went and they're starting to work at home and they're not willing to go back to their cubicles, I think that's real. And I think people are industries, businesses are really going to struggle to get those people to come back and go into those cubicle farms again. You know, we've got the opportunity to be a very interesting, you know, we've got animals, we've got food, we've got plants, biology and business. It's meaningful work. And we've sold ourselves as an industry short on the quality and the meaning of those jobs that we have to offer. I'm going to stop there. I've thrown a lot at you, and I hope you've got some questions for me.
Thank you, Richard. Does anybody have any questions that they want to ask? Please feel free to unmute yourself and ask your question.
And feel free, if there's other topics that you want to get into that's out, you know, a little bit outside of what I covered, I'm happy to do that.
First question we have from a grower was, according to your chart, what is the average wage of the farm worker in our area?
All right. So again, keep in mind, this is no supervisors in either group. Right. It's all frontline employees. The blue area is the average non-supervisory farm wage. So this is farm wages across the country, right? So they are, we're a little higher in the Northeast than we are across the country. But we're across, and using nationwide numbers, farm wages are only about 60% of non-farm wages.
So is that dollar amount, is that about $9 per hour?
Nationwide, we're just less than nine. Now in New York, we're going to be around $13, $14 on average for those frontline workers. Pennsylvania is probably $12.
Yep.
Do you think that the H-2A program is an alternative, is our alternative to a migrant labor?
Well, H-2A is, you know, in terms of places to access available workers, is probably one of the best bets for producers. And, you know, there's been a lot of producers that have, you know, participated for the first time in the last year or two. I'm not trying to sell H2A. I'm going to tell you, it's complicated. And you need to make sure you follow the rules in H2A, because there's real consequences if you screw it up. So, but it's one of the only available new sources for a lot of producers.
Isn't H2A, I know one of you has Kevin, I think you mentioned it. What is the cost for a grape in H2A? Is it like $20 an hour?
I don't know. Is it $14.92?
Yeah, so what Jen is referencing is there's a business that started in the Finger Lakes. I think they started, they're based out of Rochester, and they provide H2A services. So all of the requirements of H2A are met by this company, and you just get the labor for when you need them for, I think it's $22 or $23 an hour right now. Okay. They end up being probably a good $2 more than a grower doing it themselves when you start thinking about what it would cost in an all-inclusive perspective if you were meeting all the requirements of H2A, in addition to that adverse wage of just over $14 an hour, which is what the adverse wage is. So that's what you'll actually pay them. And then you have to think about, you know, housing and transportation and those costs if you're doing it yourself or with another grower. But that would probably be what I would budget, would be close to $20, and then add to that the adverse wage increases that happen just about every year. And so I think, Bill, that might be another option for some growers. You know, I think you cite a supply problem that just exists and there's no way around it. But you can be very flexible with wages in an effort to try to avoid H2A, because H2A is going to cost you more. So, you know, in New York State, a lot of people are losing their driver's license for the rest of their life because they're getting too many violations for drinking and driving. If you find people like that you can trust, all you have to do is give them a ride, and they have a hard time holding down a job that's not in something like agriculture, because most people don't want to give their employees a ride to work. You know, so that sort of taps into that less employable, you know, I think Richard mentioned ex-convicts, things like that, without getting into, you know, you might find that somebody who just had an issue with DWIs 20 years ago is a lot easier to rehabilitate than somebody who was, you know, I guess it depends on why they were in jail, but you know, I've talked to 3 or 4 farmers who have done something like that.
One of the issues we've run into with migrant workers being in such high demand is not only the level of pay, but the quality of work. And we are struggling to get the quality of work we want, regardless of pay. Do you think that the H2A program might be an alternative to allow us to have more control over the quality of work?
Yeah, and the other thing I would add is, with our businesses, specifically with trimming, there's been a long-standing tradition of people who prune are not really employees culturally. They're contractors, and legally they're not contractors, so we have to manage them as employees. But yeah, I mean, you highlight something that is always true, but very true when there's a shortage, is that there's not a lot of management that you can do directly to control the work product, because culturally they are contractors. So yeah, H2A, that relationship, I think, changes fundamentally. I mean, they're there for your farm. They're not even allowed to go work somewhere else unless you're doing it as a group. So completely different story.
Hey, Kevin.
Yes, Andy.
This is Andy. Do you know of any company like in Rochester, New York, for H2A workers that our guys could go to, you know, if they didn't want to go through all the paperwork and everything else and just go through a company? Is there anybody?
I don't know if there is one, but if there is and I haven't heard of it, I would actually check with Ruth, because it would probably have started in the green industry.
Right.
In Erie County.
I do know a couple of growers in Pennsylvania, and the one I know that has H2A workers now, he says that they're doing an excellent job. Mm-hmm. And I think it was like Bill said, they want to do a really good job. And So he so far has had very positive experience, but it is a lot of paperwork.
Yep.
Yes, I have another one of my growers who uses H2A and is very pleased with it. Just the hassle of getting it started up, but then they're there and you don't have to worry about not having the workforce.
Yeah. And one of the major barriers to people getting started is providing housing. You know, you have to provide housing to free of charge to employees. So sometimes that capital investment up front is prohibitive. But there's some ways around that. I mean, there's companies that are producing, for example, trailers, essentially, that are compliant with H2A requirements. And so that's one way to get into it without too much capital investment.
Yeah, I mean, with the cost of housing in our region, I would say to our growers that it's certainly something you can do. I think the resistance here on housing is going to be just from making sure that housing is compliant. That can be difficult. We have very low housing costs in our region, which also probably increases the cost of making them compliant because a lot of local people don't live in housing that would be compliant. So that would be the biggest deal is just the responsibility and time to make sure you were meeting those requirements. So a trailer would certainly avoid that hassle with, like you said, it might fit into the capital requirements and be sustainable.
Kevin, that compliance with the housing is a real good point because I know years ago we had a nursery here in Fairview that had housing and they used to have a lot of workers, but the rules on compliance got so bad that, you know, they got out. And it seems like we're coming full circle around. And that's one of the concerns that, you know, I have is do we get into that same thing where it's such a hassle with this compliance that, you know, it's tough to keep up with.
Yeah, I don't know. I would ask Richard that actually, because I think he's dealt with it a little bit more.
Well, I guess it's, so years ago, right, when you had other options, the compliance was a real hassle. Increasingly, producers are saying, well, yes, it's a hassle. Yes, there's the administrative overhead of handling that, handling the paperwork, making sure we don't hit some of those regulatory potholes that are involved in the program. But I can get quality work. I can get a reliable workforce. And again, after a couple of years, I usually work out most of the administrative challenges there. You know, it's like with anything, the first year or two is that learning curve. And then after that, you have a process worked out and things go a lot smoother. So, you know, it's like many things, it's easier for larger farms because they've typically got more people available to do the paperwork, to do the administrative work on it. For smaller farms, it's harder because, you know, you're out there trying to produce, you know, your product in addition to having to do some of the paperwork, which is substantial with H2A. So it's often the quality and the reliability offsets a lot of the headaches.
Richard, could you explain a little bit? I know that there's a lot of restrictions on the program as far as you have to be very explicit in what these workers are going to do. And then they can't just, you know, say the one farmer doesn't have any work. They can't just go down the road and work for somebody else. So could you, you know, explain maybe some of those restrictions or how explicit they have to be?
Yeah, you bet. A couple of rules. So remember, the whole program is set up. H2A was set up by the government to provide a seasonal workforce in those cases where there's not a local workforce. So a lot of the hoops that farmers have to jump through is to, first of all, verify that they're not just bringing in a less expensive, a cheap labor force from outside of the country and disadvantaging local people. So what that puts us in this spot is that you have to, you know, verify up front that yes, you can hire people locally and you need more people. You have to do some things where you don't, you know, you have a higher minimum wage basically to pay than what you would have if you had local people. You can't just use those workers in anything. You know, you have to upfront write a job description that fairly detailed says what they're going to be doing and when while they're working for you. So because of that rule, you know, if one farmer brings in an H-2A workforce and the farm down the road, for whatever reason, has a shortage this year, needs help, you can't send the H-2A workers over there because that's not on the job description. And that's a location that's not on the job description. So, and if you can hire, so you start the H-2A contract within certain rules, if local people then apply for those jobs, you have to hire them. So you could be in a situation where, you know, you need 10 people, you got 10 workers in, but then two other local people applied, you have to hire those people and you have to pay them the same as what you're paying the H-2A workers. It doesn't happen often, but it certainly can happen. You also have to pay, if this is a big change when you go to H-2A, because these are contract workers. Mostly we're both New York and Pennsylvania are at will states where you can hire and fire, you know, within reason, you know, at will. You can't do that with H-2A. When you bring people in on a contract, you're obligated to pay 2/3 of that contract, regardless of what happens. You might have a crop failure that year. You still have to pay 2/3 of that contract to those H-2A workers. So that's a couple of the things. There's just a number of things like that that you know, are important rules that have to be followed.
I know that there's a couple of farmers that are actually working together on these contracts to.
Yes.
Yeah, and that seems to be, you know, can you talk a little bit about that or maybe the more difficulty in a situation like that, which what the growers have to go through?
Yeah, I've been impressed with the growers that I've seen doing that. They're very professional. They do a great job scheduling. And that's the first thing I'll talk about is that, you know, usually you want to have your work done this week when the weather is right on your farm, right? Well, if the crew that, let's say you've got 3 or 4 or 5 farms working together, if the crew is already working somewhere else, then they're not necessarily going to be available that week to work on your farm. So the farmers have to really talk to each other, communicate a lot, and cooperate to schedule the workforce in order to, you know, keep enough work and to keep the guys busy around all those factors of, you know, growing seasons and rain and all that sort of thing. So that's part of it. And you can just imagine, you know, the more people are involved, the more complicated those logistics become. But that's something you'd understand that. Another area that is a concern, and one of the things that holds those arrangements back sometimes, is a legal catch, I guess I will say, because you're basically assuming joint liability. So if one of the growers screws up and is doing something illegal with the H-2A workers, that makes the whole group liable around those issues. And I haven't studied up on that, and I'm not an attorney that deals in those areas, but I know that's one of the issues, is that joint liability among them. So you got to really trust and have good communications and good standards among all the producers that are going to be involved in that. And, I think that's can be managed, but it needs to be very seriously talked about and managed while you have the workers here.
And Richard, that includes the contract as well, correct?
So,
or is that incorrect?
So I'm not 100% sure how the contractor that you mentioned is organized and how they're working that.
So what they do, so I guess what I was just asking is the contract. So that 2/3 that you have to pay.
Yes.
As a grower who wanted one person working with a grower who wanted 100, if that larger grower, I don't know, went bankrupt or something.
Oh, yes.
Would the grower that wanted one worker would be liable for 2/3 of the 100
yes.
employees?
Yeah, you're right. You're right, Kevin. So if you've got somebody went out of business or whatever, it couldn't meet their obligation to that 2/3, then the other people involved would have to. One way or another, the money has to be collected to pay those employees for their 2/3 time.
So my understanding of the local the Rochester-based company that served the Finger Lakes and I think is trying to serve our region but isn't yet because there's not enough interest, is I believe they hire a local supervisor who also does the transportation requirement. So they have a manager that drives them to your farm and also supervises in an effort to make sure that you, the farmer, I mean, I think they're also making sure that the work gets done, but they're also making sure that you, the farmer, is not violating any H-2A rules.
Good. Yeah, I've heard a little bit about that organization, but again, I haven't delved into it in any depth. And hopefully they're doing a great job with that. Right. Other states, you know, typically in New York, it's the growers who hire H-2A directly. You know, I showed you all that growth in Washington and North Carolina and Georgia, Florida. That's typically contractors. In those states, typically it's contractors that bring in H-2A workers and then contract with the farms to provide that labor. So we're different typically in New York, but we can use contractors. It just hasn't been as common. And I know that New York State Department of Labor has discouraged it to a degree, but it's still legal to organize things that way. Just jumping out of H-2A just for a moment, I'm familiar with some situations in the grape industry where there were people who set themselves up as labor contractors, not H-2A, just people that were providing labor. And when I talked with the growers, they were under the impression that the people working there were the employees of that labor contract. And when I looked at it, and then I analyzed that in more depth with the employers, it was clear to me that those workers are the employees of the farm. And so that means that things like I-9 verification and other work requirements, really and truly, if Department of Labor came in there, that's going to be the obligation of the farm and not of that contractor. So that's just an important thing for you to be aware of and to be thinking about. If you work with a contractor of some type, be really clear who is the employer. And in most cases in New York, you as the farm owner are going to be the employer of those employees.
Richard, if we get back onto the H-2A, yep. You said that the farmers have to verify that they can't get local labor. I mean, how do they do that verification? Because they're not just going to say, hey, I can't get local labor. How do they verify that?
Basically, they have to advertise, and it used to be really burdensome. They had to do that in certain newspapers, which could be very expensive, and to verify that they did not get a response from advertising in that way. Now you can use online tools. It's far less expensive, and that burden has been changed. But that's essentially it. You know, you advertise in advance for these jobs. You keep records to verify that I've got 10 jobs and I only got, you know, one application and that person wasn't qualified. And you have to have that documentation in place. And if you do, then you can meet that rule.
I have a question, and this question is coming from the most basic level of my understanding of the workforce. So let's say our growers do not want to use H-2A, but they are having issues finding labor. Where do they go for a workforce that is unauthorized? Is it word of mouth? You just asked to share somebody else's? I know you said contractor, but that's also a little bit worrisome to me if I were a grower. So where do you find the workforce?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, you did describe what the traditional route was. You go to the neighbor's workforce and you ask, right? And they would, you know, circulate the word among their contacts and family members and community. And soon enough, people would show up at your farm, you know, looking to fill those jobs. That pipeline has diminished. You know, as we looked at some of the numbers, that just doesn't happen now the way it did 10 years ago. There are some companies out there. There's a company called Agri Placement Services that will provide that. They're not a contractor, but they will provide services to help you find workers, predominantly Hispanic workers, to come to work on your farm. That's about it. You know, services like that, and then networking in the community.
Or H-2A. That's
how it happens, or H-2A, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody else have any questions? Please feel free to ask.
Richard, do you see, and this fits into a lot what the Lake Erie Regional Program has been working on, specifically, you know, Terry and Bates, more growers now trying to go to as much mechanization as they can for, like, instance, in our region with, you know, different mechanization for different jobs. Do you see that happening more because of the labor situation?
I'm gonna defer that one to Kevin and Jen because they're more familiar with the local industry.
Yeah, I mean, I can comment on the local industry. I don't know if for some reason, Andy, did you have a question about other industry? Or
either. I mean, do you really see, Kevin, that a lot of the growers in our region, you know, some of them are switching to mechanization, but I wouldn't say a great portion. I mean, there's more and more, but if you look at the proportion, I don't think it's that great yet. I know, and you know, I don't know how it is in other industries, if that's, you know, more common now.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you. In the last couple of years, I think we continue to see mechanization accelerate when prices are poor, not when the cost of labor is high or in short supply. There's probably some exceptions to that observation. Like, I know renewal work extended into June this year, which is pretty unsustainable. And that means that trimming work probably extended into the beginning of the growing season. So I would expect that some mechanization took place because of timing. So I think there are a number of farms that have access to machines that use them when there's no other alternative. So that is probably the only observed increase I've seen in the last couple of years, because prices have sort of compensated for these higher wage rates, which was enough to really get it done, to be honest. It doesn't feel like it, but certainly to get the trimming done. And there's probably just renewal work that isn't getting done, and that continues to expand. So I guess technically that renewal work is technically an optional activity. I mean, you can still harvest your grapes if you don't tie them up, and you know they are no ties, and you don't replace the skips. That's going to work for a year just fine. But you know, over the long term, that's a problem. I think tying and renewal work and hand follow up, if you do move towards mechanization, it puts you in a much better place to be, you know, that employer of first choice that Richard was talking about. Nobody wants to go do 40 vines an hour when it's 10 degrees below zero outside. And if you're going two or three times as fast, maybe you're riding on a trailer to do it, and you have other jobs because the amount of time it takes is just so much shorter that there are other things you're responsible for. It's a lot easier to recruit. And by a lot easier, I mean it's possible to recruit local people to do that. Whereas with pruning, I don't know of anybody who's had any luck doing that. I've heard of people trying and, you know, paying unsustainable wages to get it done. And I mean, like, very unsustainable wages, because it's typically piece rate work, and they might pay 20 or you know, they might be paying the equivalent of $20 or $30 an hour because, you know, if somebody's untrained and not accustomed to doing that kind of work, it goes very slowly. So yeah, I think the same applies to H2A. You get an H2A worker, you're not going to get somebody who spent the last 10 years pruning grapes. You're going to get somebody who might have a background or interest in agriculture. So you have an opportunity to train them to do hand follow-up, which, you know, works out well with mechanization. And I think that's what a lot of growers who are doing H2A are doing, unless they're, you know, and some of the H2A work in the Finger Lakes is focused on vinifera, and that's probably not mechanized. But outside of that vinifera production, I think a lot of it is assisting it with mechanization.
I would say broadly looking across agriculture, you know, one of the things that I get to have a perspective on here at Cornell, Cornell's Well, not so much involved in like the development of machines that go out into the fields to do the work. They're very involved in the computer systems and the visualization and all those sort of things that make those machines possible. This stuff is happening really, really fast. I point at the Apple industry for a moment. A lot of work gets done harvesting all those apples. And if you're fresh market apples, it's less than 2% of a damage rate is what's acceptable for hand harvested fresh market apples. Machines can't quite do that. They're at like 12 to 15% damage rate. And people think that, occasionally I run across people that think that, oh, that's going to prevent machines from getting there. Folks, that is just an engineering problem. You just give them a couple of years and those machines will be harvesting at a better rate than what humans can. It's going to happen. You look at the dairy industry where mechanization's been really coming on strong. There was just read an article about a Western New York dairy that I think is a rotary parlor now that is fully automated, fully robotic. 80 stall rotary parlor that just went in. And that, I know the people there, and I know that that investment, which was millions of dollars, was in large part based off of the labor situation. Farms are definitely making investments with robotics in mind to prepare for that. And the robotics are coming really, really quickly. It's going to be one of those things where it's just going to sneak up on us. They're just going to be 1 year, you're going to look around and there's going to be robots able to do a lot of this work. And like anything, the economics will start to line up as labor gets more expensive, capital investment becomes more attractive. And frankly, that's the story of agriculture for the last 100 years. I see someone there in a tractor and, you think about a tractor, how much labor did a tractor replace over the decades that used to be done by people on the ground in those fields?
Yeah, somebody older than me would have to comment, because I've heard secondhand, but when we moved to mechanized harvest, I don't remember how many years it took for that to be, go from, 10% of the industry to 95%, but I think it was like 3 or maybe 4 years. It was very fast. So when those economics play out, a lot of times when engineering solves a problem, it happens very quickly. And the same thing, might happen for the rest of our labor force, which is, especially the paid labor force is about 50%, or I shouldn't say that, the total labor force is about 50% renewal work, hand follow-up and pruning. So, and two-thirds of that is pruning. So, your paid labor could go down by 50% if there's a robotic pruner. And so when the economics of that work, it's going to dramatically shift how the industry operates.
I can tell you that there have been grants put in to continue work on a robotic pruner. Whether they get funded or not, I don't know, but we have been discussing that.
And the people ask them, will there be any jobs for people? And the answer to that is yes. Yes, you'll still have jobs. Somebody has to maintain those machines. Somebody's still going to be, analyzing the crop and all those sort of things. They're going to be higher skill jobs. They're going to be higher pay jobs. They're probably going to be more year-round type jobs. But we're also going to be better able to attract people into those jobs. So there will be an agricultural workforce. There'll be fewer people and they'll be more automated and their work's going to be that much more productive because they're working with those machines. But there will be a place for people in the agricultural industry for sure.
Any other questions for Richard or industry specific? I'll try to do my best. All right. Thank you, Richard.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. Glad to talk with all of you.
Is it all right to say that if anybody comes up with any other questions, they can email either Kevin or myself or Andy and we can forward them?
Of course. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us for this CoffeePot meeting and episode of Between the Vines. This was brought to you by Cornell University, Penn State, and of course the Lake Erie Regional Grape Program. We will see you again next week. Again, thank you all for joining us. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out and join us again for this podcast or for our CoffeePot meeting next week. Thank you.